Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Thinking big thoughts, so you don't have to.
Yeah, we do.
Here's John Williams.
This is John Williams. Hi. We're in the Allstate Skyline Studio. We sit here and stand here weekdays until 3.
Lord have mercy.
And then on Saturdays from 10 a.m. until 12 noon. I'm John. Remember, you can always follow me on social media, WGN King John. WGN King John on Facebook. Twitter and Instagram. Not doing enough on Instagram. Got to get more on Instagram. Hey, if you're a web developer, if you're an app creator, do not come up with a new platform, okay? I don't care how awesome it'll be. I don't care if it'll do an electrocardiogram while I'm jogging. I don't want any more platforms. I want no more awesome technology. I'm busy now. Good grief. That's just me. The funny thing is that a lot of that I hand off to Elif anyway. She's my producer. I go, Elif, do this thing. I don't think the president has the same, he has the same luxury, but actually I get the feeling the president actually literally picks up his phone and with his thumbs dials away. But more about that a little later on. We'll also talk with a jury consultant about who should and should not be. What is a fair? What is a representative? What is an appropriate jury? And the Jason Van Dyke murder trial, we'll talk about that actually in the 2 o'clock hour. Let's not make him wait any longer. Our Ryan Burrow from WGN Radio reports for ABC News 2. You hear him across the country. And he is where now? Ryan, where are you?
I am in Fayetteville, North Carolina. I'm actually outside of a gas station right now. Now, this gas station is open. The store itself is open, but they're out of 87 leaded gasoline. And if you go up and down this highway right here, it's pretty much hit and miss with the gas stations. You've got some gas stations that are completely shut down. The pumps aren't working. You've got some gas stations that are without gas or missing gas supplies. And then you've got stations that are fully open right now. And I don't know how long they'll remain open. The thing about gas stations is they do require power. So if the power does go out, it's going to take a little bit of time once that power is restored for them to kind of get supplies back up and going again. I'm also watching two guys at an Army surplus store as they drill holes and board up the doors. And I walked up to them and I asked them, is that to protect against, you know, the wind? Is it to protect against the rainwater as it comes in? And they said, no, it's to protect against looters.
Yeah.
So that's their big concern is you don't pay attention to it for a little while, and all of a sudden, there's an opportunity for someone to take advantage.
Ryan, what are the current conditions where you are right now?
Getting a little sprinkle. If this was in Chicago, you wouldn't think much of it. It's a little breezy outside. Nothing to write home about at this point, but this is the first time we've seen clouds in the last few days, and obviously this is the beginning of what's going to be a pretty big storm in the coming probably 24, 48 hours or so.
Yeah, it's amazing that it can be like that, and yet we know what's coming. And yet I've also been watching online cameras in Kitty Hawk, South Carolina, and the Outer Banks, and there they've got a lot of waves and a lot of wind, and that may not be a hurricane, but it is very stormy in some of the coastal cities.
Well, this is unfortunately when you get some of those goofballs out to grab their surfboards, or you say, "Here, this is the awesome time to be out and about." And it's unfortunately, you don't want the Coast Guard to come out and tap you on the shoulder and say, "Get out of the water." But that tends to happen at this time of the hurricane.
Yeah, well, you know, there's a part of me that feels like if you want to go surfing and thin the gene pool, you can. But it would be a shame to see resources diverted to you or somebody injure themselves trying to rescue you from your own stupidity, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I can tell you the resources are stacking up here in Fayetteville. We're about 90 miles out from Wilmington, where the storm is essentially supposed to breach America's shores. It's an area where a lot of these utility vehicles, power companies are starting to set up, and they're starting to be prepared because they know once this storm comes through, a lot of power is going to be out, and they're going to have to resupply that. We've heard as many as 3 million people could be out of power when all is said and done, so they've got 40,000 personnel on the ground right now, most of them from out of the area, to be prepared. In fact, at the hotel I was staying at, there were about 40 of these utility vehicles, all with Florida plates, and they were getting served lunch, so they're just waiting for their orders. They're going to wait out the storm, and then as soon as they get the thumbs up, they're heading out to wherever they need to go.
Well, maybe I have had just as much opportunity to follow the weather as you. I mean, you're driving around, but we're all dialing in. And my understanding is it's a strong Category 2 now. Is that what you're hearing as well?
Yeah, and to be honest with you, this thing is it's kind of falling apart, which, you know, when you initially hear that, you think, oh, that's good news. But actually, no. You almost kind of want at least some kind of organization when it hits landfall, because then it just kind of blows up and spills out. And unfortunately, it continues to pick up water and rain. And, you know, some of these models have up to 40 inches of rain falling along the coast of the Carolinas. I mean, that's incredible. It's catastrophic. And the winds, because they're so disorganized, now stretching out even further, some of these bands of, you know, 60, 70 mile an hour winds. So it's not necessarily good news that this is being downgraded just prior to hitting America's shores. In fact, what sounds like it's going to happen is this thing's going to fall out and just remain there for, who knows, maybe 12, 18 hours before actually coming to shore.
Well, I saw a headline this morning, and again, you know, between when sometimes headlines are published and then when we talk about it, things have changed. But they said that North Carolina, South Carolina, maybe where you are, but you're going to get 8 months of rain in the, you know, in 3 days. 8 months of rain in 72 hours, something like that. I mean, it's just this deluge. So maybe the number 2, 3, 4 doesn't matter so much. It's just the total amount of rain that's going to come in, huh?
And this area is already pretty saturated, the ground. So, I mean, the thoughts of where this water is going to go, especially in the hilly territories, I mean, it's tough to think about. And that's why we've already seen, even where I'm at right now, some of these shelters, 7 of them in the county, have already started filling up. They've got room for about 1,200 people, and they've already seen hundreds of people register and begin to stay at these shelters because they don't want to be caught in this storm when it starts. They'd rather have a place solidified. They'd wait out the storm and then kind of go from there. But, you know, this is a storm that not a lot of people are going to mess around with after what they saw with Hurricane Matthew.
WGN Radio's Ryan Burrows on the line. Where are you again? For folks that are just joining us, give me your location.
I'm in Fayetteville, North Carolina, so about 90 miles northwest of Wilmington. And this is a staging area for FEMA. It's where Fort Bragg is. So there will be a lot of resources that are going to be pulled from this area to head to hopefully the most dangerous zones. And hopefully this won't be one of the most dangerous zones. But that being said, as much as 15 inches of rain is expected to fall between now and Saturday.
And how far then does that put you from the coast?
If you go directly east, maybe 50 or 60 miles.
Yeah.
But this storm should be a little bit south of that direct route. So we'll see. I mean, this thing is supposed to turn southward and poke more into South Carolina and really start having some impact on northern Georgia as well before kind of sputtering out and going into the Appalachians.
Yeah. So where are you staying?
Wouldn't you like to know? it is a home to suite. I got booted from the hotel I was at last night. I tried to, you know, the thing about, you know, this job is you don't know if you're going to be moved around. So to book a hotel well in advance is difficult because, you know, you don't want to book a hotel for 5 days and then have to cancel 2 days in and they charge you for it. So I only booked for one night last night at the Embassy Suites. And I tried to rebook this morning, and they said, nope, sorry, full house. It's probably because of all of those utility workers, and so I actually found a place down the street. I booked for a couple of days now, so hopefully I'm staying put here, but, you know, hotels are tough to come by now with all the evacuees and all of these service workers.
Yeah, well, it sounds like maybe you're more fighting for rooms with the people that are coming in to help than the people that are seeking refuge. Maybe if I were going to flee my coastal home, I would go even further west than where you are, Ryan.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, you'd still be in the cane of the storm, too. I mean, if you want to evacuate completely, it's probably a good idea to just get out of the storm cone altogether and maybe head up to Virginia. A lot of people are going with family members. I talked to one gentleman who's who fled from Wilmington, and he said that he thought that this would be kind of a good place out of the reach, but he felt like he could still get back in a few days to his home once this storm passes if need be. So, you know, everyone's got kind of different decisions on this. For some people, it's a vacation. Hey, let's just get out of Dodge for a couple of weeks and get back when everything's back to normal. Some people anxious to get home. We'll see. Once this storm hits and people have been sitting around in a cooped-up hotel for, you know, a few days, how antsy they start to get.
All right. Well, I appreciate your coverage, and we'll visit with you or listen for you later this afternoon and then maybe talk to you again tomorrow. But just one last tip for you, Ryan, and I don't want to tell you how to do your job, but I'm watching HLN, Fox News, and CNN, and the Weather Channel, and it seems to me like you need to be standing with waders on in the water, and you need to be screaming into your microphone as you're being whipped about. I don't know what you're doing out there, but it would seem to me like that's how you're supposed to do it.
Give it some time. It's coming. I've got those big boots and my wet gear in the trunk right now, and you know, we'll see how and when I have to use those, but they are ready.
I want the shot of you where you're standing there with an umbrella you bought at Walgreens, and it's inside out, you know, and you're getting battered about. So that'll demonstrate the power of the storm.
You should have seen me. You should have seen me covering Hurricane Harvey last year. It was not pretty. It did not have the proper gear on. Let's say, let me just say that, and a little bit more prepared this time around.
Learned your lesson, huh? All right.
Yeah.
Well, be safe and keep doing what you're doing, my friend. We'll talk later.
All right. See ya.
This was the president the other day talking about the job we did after the hurricane. There were two, but Maria hit Puerto Rico.
I think Puerto Rico was incredibly successful. Puerto Rico was actually our toughest one of all because it's an island, so you can't truck things onto it. Everything's by boat. We moved a hospital into Puerto Rico, a tremendous military hospital in the form of a ship. You know that?
Let's talk to Mike for a second here. Hey, Mike, you're on WGN. What did you want to say? Hi.
Well, hi, John. As an aside, that ship that they moved to Puerto Rico, it didn't actually take on patients. I think the total patients they served and the whole time they were there was under 100 just due to mismanagement. And my point was that you can definitely attribute those 3,000 deaths to the hurricane. It's fair to say that. I mean, for example, if I shot somebody and they lived, I'd be charged with manslaughter. If they died 6 months later, I'm up to murder one, right?
If their death is attributed to the gunshot,
yeah. So these people died: lack of hygiene, lack of water, lack of electricity, lack of refrigeration. Didn't get their meds. So you can definitely point their deaths to the hurricane, not some sort of deep state plot to tarnish Trump. You know, for whatever reason, that was mismanaged. The hospital sat there unused. There are, you know, John, there are still pallets of water on the airstrip in Puerto Rico that have
that.
Never been distributed.
I saw that.
Yeah, so you know, the fragile nature of human beings. You know, you miss water for 5 days on top of your heart condition, on top of your disease, and now you have dysentery because your food wasn't refrigerated. If the hurricane hadn't happened, you'd still be alive. So the idea of giving you, you know, I give myself an A+. It was the toughest one ever. Well, that's just insulting. It's insulting. And
well,
you know,
it's just so short-sighted. It's short-sighted because it assumes that the only way to die in a hurricane is to get knocked over or hit by a coconut, and then you die. The hurricane killed you. Another way to die from a hurricane is you can't get water, and you dehydrate, and you die from complications, or you're old and frail, and you would have lived otherwise, but now you don't because your body can't stand it, or a whole host of things like you've just suggested. So I was wondering, though, what the truth in all of this was. The president said that it's not just deep state, but it's worse than that. It's the Democrats. It's right there. This is their plot to embarrass him. And I was wondering, though, if that six-month marker is fair and if the president has some truth to this. Anyway, the Pinocchio test, if you go to PolitiFact.com, they give the president's claim that 3,000 people were not the result of the hurricane. Four Pinocchios. they don't buy that either. I appreciate the phone call, Mike. Thank you, sir. It is 1:39 on WGN Radio. John Williams here in the Skyline Studio, just over my shoulder, looking out onto beautiful Chicago, Columbus Avenue, the river up north to the lake. I can see the blue waters, but along the way, a big, thick line of people snaking across the sidewalk over by NBC and then a down around to behind the Tribune Tower heading westward towards Michigan Avenue. They've all got the signs. You can see the red and white. Those are the colors of the strike, I guess. But there's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people. A caravan of police bicyclists are riding alongside them, sort of corralling them in as it snakes its way westward downtown. That's a lot of people in the hotel business that ain't working right now that are striking and making themselves very visible downtown Chicago.
But they are expected to stay on the sidewalk.
And they are. This is very cooperative and peaceful.
Yes. Oh,
I didn't realize that. I know you've been talking about that, V, but they got to be on the sidewalk, huh?
Yeah, they're headed up. They're heading to Michigan Avenue, and then they're going to head up north to Oak Street. I don't know if they plan on, you know, getting in the street at Oak Street, but they are expected to stay on the sidewalk. And like you said, there's a heavy police presence. There are going to be delays, though, on Michigan.
Yeah, because I suppose if they go up Michigan Avenue right now, you would probably close one lane if they spill out into, I mean, the cops and everybody, you know, it's a pretty thick bunch of people. Maybe they'll be able to keep them on the sidewalk. If you're doing any shopping at the Nike store on Michigan Avenue, you better get in and get out because access is going to be difficult when this thing snakes by. It's a long line of people, very long. I mean, like...
And they have been very loud in their protests with their chants, not in a bad way, but just they've made themselves visible, definitely.
Yeah, you and I walk around downtown every day, and I walk by probably four or five hotels where they've been striking. Striking takes work. I guess you could stay home. You know, you could watch TV if you wanted, but these folks are showing up, and instead of collecting a paycheck, they're out there banging away, chanting, making noise, not threatening that I've been able to see or harassing the customers. I mean, I've been right through their ranks as I walk by them. They didn't know if I was going in or out of the hotel. And I haven't seen any reporting that they're harassing the customers. I thought that's what they would do. I thought if you really want to make a point, keep people from going into the hotel. Then the hotel loses business. Then you've got some leverage. But if people are just able to walk about, the hotel is still doing business, not as well. The beds aren't being made as well, and you got to wait longer for room service if you can get it at all. So they're impacting operations. But I thought, go after the customers, and then you get the manager's attention.
John, I actually heard an interview with a guest at one of the hotels, and the reporter was asking him and his wife if they got fresh towels, fresh sheets, anything like that. And he said they were there for 4 days. There was not one person in the room at all to change the sheets or anything like that. They were told if they did want fresh towels and linens, they could go down to the front desk and get it.
Oh, wow.
Okay, that is impacting business then, isn't it?
And it's also shut down a couple of the hotel restaurants because they depend on the hotel staff. We're talking about bartenders here too, and some of the wait staff.
So servers, cooks.
Yeah, they've had to shut down some of the restaurants in some of the hotels if they're not independently being operated.
I heard an interview with a couple of customers of one of the hotels, and the woman said, "I support these workers." She said, "It's kind of a hassle. You know, I'm just trying to stay in the city and do my thing, and I've got to walk through this, and it's noisy and loud, but I feel for these people." And I thought, I wonder what the almost ethical is not the right word. But if you were really true to those words, then you wouldn't stay in that hotel, right? I mean, that's the point. They don't want you staying in that hotel. Now, it's 26 hotels in the city right now. There's more than 26 hotels. But if you really wanted to side with them, you wouldn't book a room at the Sheraton right now. I don't know that people are doing that per se.
Well, I have a feeling a lot of people that are coming from out of town have no idea.
Well, that's it.
Yeah, I mean, once they get here, then they realize what's happening.
And it's not your issue. I mean, it's not even your city if you're a traveler. So, yeah, you pop into Chicago and you see this and you go, oh, crap, well, that's bad for them. But I've got to stay in Chicago. What am I supposed to do? So I'm not faulting those people. But, you know, when you boycott an automaker, I remember back in the 70s and 80s when I was living and working in Peoria, I guess it was the 80s, you know, you did not want to be seen driving a Japanese car. You know, you put your money where your mouth is. That was a union town. It was a Made in America town. Caterpillar tractors are made in Peoria. And while you didn't have any business buying a tractor, it looked bad when you were driving anything but a Ford pick-em-up truck. You'd go to the parking lot of a Caterpillar plant. It may still be this way. Maybe not. But it would just be filled with domestic cars. Domestic cars, domestic cars, domestic trucks, domestic cars. Funny thing is, Mitsubishis were being made just down the street in Bloomington. I mean, you know, that doesn't exactly make sense, but that was the idea. So now they're past the NBC building now. And they are thick and gathered on the east side of the Tribune Tower, where there used to be a really good radio station. And they're, I guess, probably making that turn now north onto Michigan Avenue. The hundreds of the thousands of striking hotel workers in Chicago today. In fact, Violetta, out my window, here's the one vantage point of being at 303 East Wacker, way up high in this skyscraper.
Michigan looks like it's a standstill.
Exactly.
Northbound.
Yeah. Now, I do see it starting to just sort of creep forward in a northerly direction.
Yeah, but you can definitely tell the left lane is slowly crawling, but the two right lanes seem to be moving over to the left. So expect some delays northbound. They are headed to Oak Street.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they're going to span, I mean, if they do stay in a confined area on the sidewalk, they're going to be taking up a lot of that once they all get out onto Michigan Avenue.
That's the story as we watch it from overhead in our little radio box in the sky here.
It's hard not to get into it.
Well, you know, you're funny because you can tell that it's not really impacting you. You're feeding off the energy and the enthusiasm. It's easy to side with these people, but you're almost making it feel like it's fun. And I'll bet those people don't think it's as much fun as you do walking by on your way to work, Violetta.
I agree with you. Their livelihood is on the line.
It is.
Mine is not.
I have only once been in a position where, I mean, we were all gathered in an office, in a conference room, and it was 11:30 at night, and the strike breakers were at the radio station. So at midnight, the contract expired. And at 12:01, we were all not going to be on the air. Producers, news people, announcers, granted there aren't that many of them there at midnight, but it was a fully staffed radio station. It was a news talk station like this. And the strike breakers were in the building. They were in other rooms. And they were going to take our jobs literally at midnight. And there, you know, so we're there deciding whether or not we are going to extend the contract or not. And you feel very strongly about the issues that you want to go on strike. But when you do, you're not getting paid. And so what is today, the 13th? So these people are going on 2 weeks without a paycheck. You could see how sometimes the company has some leverage too, right? Like as much as you don't want to have your customers going downstairs and getting a towel, the employees maybe can only last so long too.
Well, and not all the employees necessarily want the strike, but being part of the union, you know, majority rules.
That's a tough situation. That's a tough. So I'll finish my story now that you mentioned it, Violetta. So there was like maybe 50 of us at the station, and they knew, particularly as a new hire and a new member to the on-air union at that radio station, that while I was on board, I didn't have a history there. I wasn't fully vested, literally or figuratively, in the company. And so I didn't want to give up the pay. I did not want to give up the pay. I'm like, really, you guys? I mean, we just moved. I got young kids. I don't have a lot of savings. I'm not making that much money. I need my next paycheck. And so they call out the vote. And they say, okay, well, I forget what the first number was, but say it was 49-1. We are 49-1 in favor of the strike. And I'm like, I know what they're thinking. They're thinking it's me. They're thinking I'm the one. Everybody in this room knows that I was new and a little cautious about this. And I felt all of the eyes in the room kind of looking but not looking at me. I knew what they were thinking, and it was making me sick. I'm sitting there, and there's this quiet. as everybody wondered who the one was. So I volunteered. I said, hey, I'm not the one, just so you guys know. Which they all kind of looked at me like, okay, that was weird.
The new guy.
I know. What do you, shut up, dummy. What, nobody said, you know, nobody asked. We're not calling people out here, but I sure felt it. And then as soon as I said, I'm not the one, I felt like, oh God, that was a stupid thing to say. I mean, who is the one? Okay, I don't care. It could have been two. It would have been me, but I wasn't the one. And I wanted them to know that.
How old were you when this was happening, John?
I was in my 30s.
Wow.
But, you know,
that's tough.
Why do you ask?
I was just curious, you know, being a new member of a team and being put in that situation, and depending on where you were in your career, say you were 22, fresh out of college or something like that, and really not been in the business, I just think it would have possibly been different. It's a tough situation.
I think you're
way.
Right.
It's intimidating.
Yeah. Well, it is. And, you know, if you say you're 22, you don't have a lot of money, but you, who cares, right? You've got 45 years to work in front of you, and nobody at the age of 22 has any money or savings or cars or houses, right?
Especially in this business.
Exactly. So, I mean, so you could vote to go on strike and you don't get paid, but that's okay. You weren't paying me anything anyway. But I was at a point where I actually had a house. I had a couple cars. I had a couple little children. And that was the worst time for me anyway, personally, to ever go on strike. You know, these old guys who'd been there forever, they were fine. They could handle it, and then the newbies maybe didn't care, but I thought, I am new and in a sweet spot. This is a very difficult vote for me. But I voted for the strike. And then in the last minute, literally, they came to terms with the company, and the strike breakers packed up their bags and took the elevator down, and we resumed our broadcast as if nothing had happened. Whew. Okay, sorry, a little detour there.
Thinking big thoughts, so you don't have to.
I really do.
Here's John Williams.
Toss and turn at night for you. This is John. We're in the Allstate Skyline Studio, downtown Chicago, overlooking a beautiful city. The strikers have left my view. They're heading north on Michigan Avenue, I believe. We'll keep you posted on that. And by that, I mean Violetta will do all the work. On social media. Like me on Facebook. I'm WGN King John. Same on Twitter. Same on Instagram. WGN King John. I've posted my second of a series of book reviews on Bob Woodward's Fear, Trump in the White House. I've been reading the book. I'm on chapter 10. People are just, and a lot of you are commenting on my Facebook page about your reviews of, you're listening to or reading the book as well. Some of you appreciate what I'm saying. Some of you say the book is positively terrifying. Honestly, I haven't found it as horrifying as I thought it would be. I find myself laughing sometimes. The book rings true. And today I highlight one passage that I think the president would be happy to read were he to read the book. Some of it is actually not awful about Donald Trump, and then some of it is, and some of it, most of it, is just gobsmacking. I'm not sure if I'm using that word right or if it's a phrase, gobsmacking, but you just go, holy cow, can you believe this? I can't believe this. There's a lot of that in this book. Speaking of presidents, Teddy Roosevelt's going to be in town. You know, we do these about once every 6 months conversation with the president. We always like to schedule one of them near the election. And so look at this. Teddy Roosevelt is coming back, and tickets went on sale yesterday. We normally do two sold-out shows for Teddy Roosevelt this fall. We're only going to do one. It'll be Saturday, November 10th at 10:30 in the morning at the Blizzard Theater. That's the theater at the Dairy Queen on State Street. Just kidding. That's the theater at the Elgin Community College campus. So Elgin Community College, where we were last year for one of the shows, we're going to be there again this year, Saturday the 10th, 10:30 in the morning. And it's our boy TR who's going to talk about leadership. And whatever the heck else he wants to talk about. You know, the last time I spoke to him, we talked about how he was an exceptional president for a lot of reasons.
The youngest president ever in the history of this country, 42, and I left office at 50, the youngest former president.
Author of 35 books?
At least 35, depending on how you count. I wrote more than 35 books, several of them American classics. And let me just say, the next writingest president of American history, who would that be? John Quincy Adams. He wrote 12 books, all unreadable.
You were a Nobel Peace Prize winner.
We settled the Russo-Japanese War, and because of that, I became the first American to win the Nobel Peace Prize. I'm often seen as a warmonger. And by the way, I do like war. But I was a man of peace as president. I was the first president to win the Nobel Peace Prize. I was the first president to leave this country during his time as president. I went to see my canal in Panama. I was the first president.
Excuse me, your canal?
And then he goes on about that. You get the idea. Some of the stories are just heartbreaking. We have shed tears on that stage as TR tells us about his life, about the life and death of his sons, about charging up San Juan Hill, about the Panama Canal. He's an exceptional person, and he comes to life on stage. So, well, how do you get your tickets? I don't even think I mentioned that. Go to WGNRadio.com. What do you know? Go to WGNRadio.com. /events/events, WGNRadio.com/events. Or you can call the Blizzard Theater box office right now, and that number is 847-622-0300. 847-622-0300. It is sponsored by American Sale. So Eric just told you in WGN Radio News about the jury for Jason Van Dyke, the officer almost 4 years ago charged with killing Laquan McDonald, the 17-year-old who was walking down that street and was shot 16 times in a matter of about 6 seconds. He was reloading when the other officers stopped him. So it's a case that the whole country is watching. A couple of days ago, The New Yorker had a long article by Alex Kotlowitz about it. Literally, The New Yorker and other publications across the country are paying a lot of attention to this trial. And the jury selection is completed. Eric, let me see if I got the numbers right. 7 white jurors.
That's correct.
3 Hispanic.
Correct.
That's 10. 1 Asian American and 1 African American.
Correct.
All right. Okay. Okay.
That's not the way. They still need to pick 4 alternates.
Yeah. Yes. Well, maybe those will be African Americans. You know, our news click is going to be this. We'll say that and then say, look, it doesn't matter. People are people. Or, oh, no, red flag, red flag, red flag. I mean, look, this is being tried in Cook County, Illinois. The black population in Cook County is 25%. I thought it would be higher. It's 25. 1 in 4 people in Cook County are African American. I would then hope that the jury would reflect that. You want a jury of your peers? Then why don't we have 3 African Americans on that panel? Now, there's a guy named Dave Zahner, and he is a jury consultant here in Chicago, and he's on a phone line. Dave, this is John. You're on WGN Radio. How are you, sir?
Doing great. Thanks for having me on.
Jump in the conversation. So there's my red flag already. Am I premature about that? What's your, I mean, that's all we know. Actually, we do know a little bit more about some of the jurors. One of them is the black is a 51-year-old or in her 50s, I think UPS or Federal Express driver. She said she's seen the video of Laquan being shot. She said she doesn't know if it's murder or not. She's open to the particulars of the case, but she's worried about how many shots were fired. That woman is on the panel. What's your first observation about the makeup of this group?
The first observation is that it's, as you mentioned, it's pretty representative of Cook County as a whole. Cook County as a whole is generally a quarter African American, a third Hispanic Latino, Asian American, white, and the panel is pretty close to that. And I believe a couple of alternates have been selected who are African Americans also. So, and given that the trial is going to be a little longer, it wouldn't be surprising to see some of the alternates end up moving on to the main panel.
Okay, that's interesting. But one of the 12 as it is now is African American. And if it was purely representative, it would be 3. So we're missing 2 by my count. And in my world, I would want, if I was the prosecution, I would want 3 or 4. I mean, Jason Van Dyke and his people must be looking at 1 and liking their chances demographically anyway. Don't you think that...
Yes, demographically they're happy, and that's how it almost always happens. When one side is, Jason Van Dyke's lawyers use a lot of their peremptory strikes on African Americans, and that's one of the reasons why the numbers of African Americans are slightly lower in the overall panel than in the population at large.
Dave, I hate the insinuation. I hate what I'm saying. You know, what I'm saying is blacks will side with a black and whites will side with a white. I don't mean that, but I guess that's in the back of our minds. That's what's happening here, right?
Well, I think it's a little more complicated than that. I think what has been happening is that the defense especially is very concerned about people who have seen the video and have formed an opinion based on the video. And it turns out that just on the limited sample we've seen from the people who were selected as part of the voir dire process is that more African Americans had seen the video than other groups, and more had formed an opinion. So therefore, they were more likely to be excluded either for cause or for peremptory challenges by the defense.
Right.
But, so it's kind of a little bit of self-selection process.
Well, sure it is, but stop right there because, right, the fact that those African-Americans had seen the video, you can't pull somebody because of their race, right? You can't say, I don't want a black on this jury because that's a white cop and that'll be hard for us. You can't, based on their race, exclude them from the jury pool. Is that correct?
Exactly. There have been several Supreme Court decisions that limit the ability of parties in a case to eliminate people just based on race or other protected classes.
Right. But if a black person says, I've seen it, and boy, it looks to me like I think Jason Van Dyke's guilty of murder, well, then you don't want that person regardless of their color.
Exactly, and that's what they would call a non-race-based reason for exclusion. And generally, what the defense was doing is saying that anyone who had seen the video and had expressed an opinion, whether they were African American, white, Latino, Asian, that those people should be excluded. The problem was there were so many people who had seen the video and formed opinions that they've ended up seating several people who have seen the video and have already formed some opinions, but have said they could at least put those opinions aside. And while maybe the demographics looks pretty good for the defense, the fact that they have several people who have already expressed some concern about what they've seen in the video, that's a tough place for them to be, and they're going to have to make a decision about whether or not they want to stay with the jury or decide to have the judge decide this.
What would you look for in a good juror if you were Jason Van Dyke's representatives?
I would be looking for someone who has a pre-existing disposition towards the police. You'd like to have people who, for example, maybe have been in the military or have some understanding of what it's like to be in a situation where you feel your life is threatened. That doesn't make up a very large portion of people, though, and it doesn't look from what I've seen so far that they've had, except potentially for one juror, people who have that kind of background, who can express how it might have been like for Jason Van Dyke to be in this situation and why he may have done something that from the outside looks like a difficult thing to understand.
Yeah, but that's why I would also, just in fairness, want some young African Americans who say, okay, and I want you to know what it's like on the streets of Chicago. I want you to know what our life is like and how police treat us and how wrong it feels what Van Dyke did and how believable it is that Jason Van Dyke did what he did, because we put up with that crap all day long. So, you know, the other side probably wants somebody like that, right?
Yeah, the prosecution definitely made a point that they felt that the defense was unfairly eliminating African Americans, especially for that reason, that they wanted a wide variety of opinions on the jury in order to fairly evaluate the case. And I think that you're exactly right about that.
Dave, I got to take a break. Dave Zahner's on the phone line. Come back with me in just a second here. He is a private practicing attorney who is a jury consultant here in Chicago. But one other real quick question. So I cannot exclude somebody because of their race. It has to be maybe they're a person of color, but they've also prejudiced themselves. They've already made up their mind about the case. Then, of course, they shouldn't be on that. Does the same apply to whites, though? That is, you can't exclude somebody because of their race if they're black. Is the same true for whites?
Actually, it's not. It has to be what is called a protected class. So the Supreme Court said someone's race, ethnicity, religion, something that would those people cannot be excluded based on those areas. So while no one would ever say they were doing this, if someone wanted to exclude people because they said, well, I feel that they are, for example, an older white male, and I don't feel that they would be sympathetic to my client, that would be perfectly acceptable as a reason if they were using one of their preemptory challenges, just based on how the Supreme Court set up the rules under a decision called Batson, that sometimes you'll hear referred to as a Batson challenge.
Stay right there. My number is 312-981-7200. Lots of texts have come in the last, 60 seconds. We're visiting with a jury consultant. His name is Dave Zahner. He's in business here in Chicago. A moment ago, I said you were an attorney. I was wrong about that. You're not an attorney, though, right? You work with attorneys. Is that it, Dave?
Correct. Correct. We get hired by attorneys to help them prepare their cases for trial and to help with jury selections.
Okay. The number is 312-981-7200. Maybe you've got a question or a comment. Hey, Tim, you're on the air. What do you want to say?
Hey, John, how you doing? You know what? I listen to WGN all day, and when this conversation started, you really hit me trouble because it sounds to me as if you're saying that everybody out there is only going to vote based on the race, that the pigmentation in their own flesh. If I'm light-skinned, I'm going to protect a white guy. If I'm dark-skinned, I'm going to protect a black guy. And those are your words, not mine, because you keep saying, I want more African-American, I want more African-American. And I'm wondering, well, where in God's green earth is our jury system at if that's what you believe? If you believe that white people only go with a white guy and black people only go with a black guy. Yeah. I think that's a bunch of malarkey, and unless I'm reading you wrong or I'm completely hearing you wrong, that pretty much is what you've just said over the last 15 minutes.
I'm glad you're listening. I think there's some of that in what I've said, and I think there's some of that in the courtrooms. So thanks for calling me out on that, Tim. And Dave, what do you say about all of that?
Yeah, actually, Tim, one of the things that I always tell my clients is that one of the biggest mistakes you could make would be to just judge people based on their skin color and make assumptions based on that. What you want to be looking at, and what we always advise our clients, is that you need to be looking at people's pre-existing attitudes, experiences, and beliefs. And I apologize if I wasn't as clear as that as I could have been. One of the things that I was trying to say earlier was that that it isn't that people are African-American, and that's why the Jason Van Dyke people think they may not be good jurors for them. It's that it's through some of the stuff they have done, they have found out that more people who are African-American have seen this video and have already formed pre-existing opinions. And that's why there's some of the demographic things that we're seeing. And sometimes demographics is used as a marker for pre-existing opinions. But it's always important to realize that that's not exactly what is going on. Instead, you're looking at the pre-existing opinions that people have and whether or not that can make them fair or unfair jurors.
Tim, thank you.
And that's something I always advise my clients about.
Tim, I'm going to go from you to Dan. You're on WGN. Dan, what did you want to say? You've got a question. You're on the air.
Yeah, I got one or two questions. Do you think the defense in this case is hoping for a hung jury, so they only want maybe one or two jurors that might side their way? And the second question, given that, what is the educational makeup of the jurors? Do we know how many have college degrees versus high school degrees only? Because it's my opinion, if you only have a high school degree, you're predisposed to have more of a prejudicial opinion regarding African Americans and the cops.
Okay, let's let him respond to either of those. Go ahead, Dave.
Sure. First thing is, what's interesting is a lot of studies have shown that people with more education are more likely to sometimes have stereotypical ideas because they've formulated more knowledge base, and therefore they think they know more when they actually don't. And therefore, a lot of times, education can lead to more stereotypical ideas, which is an interesting finding in some of the social science research. But I think the educational background, there are several people with college degrees and then several people. So it's a good mix, and it's a good underlying representation. And I think it'll give a pretty good background for people to hear the evidence of the case.
I'm counting color here, and I know that's bad. And you're telling me we should not be looking at that. That's not a factor, or is that a slight factor? Put it in some context for us.
I think that what sometimes is it's a marker people use. And it's not, I think that if this was a jury with no African Americans on it, that might be difficult for the community as a whole to accept, and that's very understandable. So I think it's a good thing to look at to make sure that the jury is representative, and I think that's what the judge has been working really hard to do in this case, is make sure he has a representative jury. And just really looking from the outside in, it looks like he's done a pretty good job of that.
I hope you can join us again. I mean, this thing's just now getting underway, but they have the 12 and at least two, I guess, of the alternates picked. So we'll continue to follow the case. And I appreciate your time and expertise today, Dave.
Thanks a lot for having me on, John. I really enjoyed it.
His name is Dave Zahner. Rokan, Anna DeVlantis, getting all wound up. What are you guys going to do today?
Well, we're going to start. Our own Ryan Burrow is in North Carolina right now, and he's going to be able to bring us the latest as that storm is starting to hit.
He's not close enough to the water. Tell him to get closer to the water.
Oh. Are we worried about him?
Right as the authorities are saying, get away from the water! We're going to go get closer to the water.
I thought that's what they were supposed to do, the reporters.
Yeah. Well, it's a funny thing because the reporters are like, stay away, stay away, stay away. By the way, here we are.
Or else you're watching cable news. I was watching cable news today and you saw the warnings of they need to get out of here. And most people have heeded the mandatory evacuation order. And then you see all the surfers just kind of running joyfully behind them. Like, yeah, surf's up. Let's hang out on the beach.
I do want to say what... When they're like, what are you still doing here? I want one person to say, what are you doing here?
Yeah, right. That's the right answer.
At least I have a house here.
Right. I'm protecting my stuff here. That's what I'm doing. You're getting paid.
You flew into this, Jack. Why are you here?
And you look great in that tight black T-shirt.
A lot of that going on, isn't there?
I mean, I get it. I think when people are sitting there going, we just going to sit it out. This is my 16th hurricane, and it'll be just fine. I mean, okay. I mean, it's up to you to decide that, and it's kind of up to your family, and I'm sure that a lot of these people are the people that, you know, the ones who are like, I'm doing this and I don't care what you say, are the people that the family doesn't want you Thanksgiving anyway. So, yeah, look at it that way.
I'm going to go, but before I do, I just want to alert the newsroom to not use as a soundbite you doing the North Carolina man just now. That wasn't a real North Carolina man. That was just Roe.
That's actually Cousin Cooter. That's one of the guys on the show. Right. So that's who that is.
Have a good one, guys.
All right. Thank you very much.